Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Today we're up to Epilogue 1, Chapter 10. Natasha had married in the early spring of 1813, and in 1820 already had three daughters, besides a son for whom she had longed and for whom she was now nursing. She had grown stouter and broader so that it was difficult to recognize the slim, lively Natasha of former days in this robust, motherly woman. Her features were more defined and had a calm, soft and serene expression. In her face there was none of the ever-glowing animation that had formerly burned there and constituted its charm. Now her face and body were often all that one saw, and her soul was not visible at all. All that struck the eye was a strong, handsome and fertile woman. The old fire very rarely kindled in her face now. That happened only when, as was the case that day, her husband returned home, or a sick child was convalescent, or when she and Countess Mary spoke of Prince Andrew. She never mentioned him to her husband, who she imagined was jealous of Prince Andrew's memory, or on the rare occasions when something happened to induce her to sing, a practice she had quite abandoned since her marriage. At the rare moments when the old fire kindled in her handsome, fully developed body, she was even more attractive than in her former days. Since their marriage, Natasha and her husband had lived in Moscow, in Petersburg, on their estate near Moscow, or with her mother, that is to say, in Nicholas's house. The young Countess Bezukhova was not often seen in society, and those who met her there were not pleased with her, and found her neither attractive nor amiable. Not that Natasha liked solitude, she did not know whether she liked it or not. She even thought that she did not, but with her pregnancies, her confinements, the nursing of her children, and sharing every moment of her husband's life, she had demands on her time which could only be satisfied by renouncing society. All who had known Natasha before her marriage wondered at the change in her as at something extraordinary. Only the old countess, with her maternal instinct, had realized that all Natasha's outbursts had been due to her need of children and a husband. As she herself had once exclaimed at Otradnoye, not so much in fun as in earnest. And her mother was now surprised by the surprise expressed by those who had never understood Natasha, and kept saying that she had always known that Natasha would make an exemplary wife and mother. "Only she lets her love of her husband and her children overflow all bounds," said the Countess, so that it even becomes absurd. Natasha did not follow the golden rule advocated by clever folk, especially the French, which says that a girl should not let herself go when she marries, should not neglect her accomplishments, should be even more careful of her appearance than when she was unmarried, and should fascinate her husband as much as she did before he became her husband. Natasha, on the contrary, had at once abandoned all her witchery, of which her singing had been an unusually powerful part. She gave it up just because it was so powerfully seductive. She took no pains with her manners, or with delicacy of speech, or with her toilet, or to show herself to her husband in her most becoming attitudes, or to avoid inconveniencing him by being too exacting. She acted in contradiction to all those rules. She felt that the allurements instinct had formerly taught her to use would now be merely ridiculous in the eyes of her husband, to whom she had from the first moment given herself up entirely, that is, with her whole soul, leaving no corner of it hidden from him. She felt that her unity with her husband was not maintained by the poetic feelings that had attracted him to her, but by something else, indefinite but firm, as the bond between her own body and soul. To fluff out her curls, put on fashionable dresses, and sing romantic songs to fascinate her husband would have seemed as strange as to adorn herself to attract herself. To adorn herself for others might perhaps have been agreeable, she did not know, but she had no time at all for it. The chief reason for devoting no time either to singing, to dress, or to choosing her words was that she really had no time to spare for these things. It is known that man has the faculty of becoming completely absorbed in a subject, however trivial it may be, and it is known that there is no subject so trivial that it will not grow to infinite proportions if one's entire attention is devoted to it. The subject which wholly engrossed Natasha's attention was her family, that is, her husband, whom she had to keep so that he should belong entirely to her, and to the home and the children whom she had to bear, bring into the world, nurse, and bring up. And the deeper she penetrated, not with her mind only, but with her whole soul, her whole being, into the subject that absorbed her, the larger did that subject grow, and the weaker and more inadequate her own powers appeared, so that she concentrated them all on that one thing, and yet was unable to accomplish all that she considered necessary. There were then, as there are now, conversations and discussions about women's rights, the relations of husband and wife, and their freedom and rights, though these themes were not yet termed questions as they are now, but those topics were not merely uninteresting to Natasha. She positively did not understand them. Those questions, then as now, existed only for those who see nothing in marriage but the pleasure married people get from one another, that is, only the beginnings of marriage and not its whole significance, which lies in the family. Discussions and questions of that kind, which are like the questions of how to get the greatest gratification from one's dinner, did not then and do not now exist for those for whom the purpose of a dinner is the nourishment it affords, and the purpose of marriage is the family. If the purpose of dinner is to nourish the body, a man who eats two dinners at once may perhaps get more enjoyment, but will not attain his purpose, for his stomach will not digest the two dinners. If the purpose of marriage is the family, the person who wishes to have many wives or husbands may perhaps obtain much pleasure, but in that case will not have a family. If the purpose of food is nourishment, and the purpose of marriage is the family, the whole question resolves itself into not eating more than one can digest, and not having more wives or husbands than are needed for the family. That is, one wife or one husband. Natasha needed a husband. A husband was given her, and he gave her a family. And she not only saw no need of any other or better husband, but as all the powers of her soul were intent on serving that husband and family, she could not imagine, and saw no interest in imagining, how it would be if things were different. Natasha did not care for society in general, but prized the more the society of her relatives, Countess Mary and her brother, her mother, and Sonya. She valued the company of those to whom she could come striding, dishevelled from the nursery in her dressing gown, and with joyful face show a yellow instead of a green stain on baby's napkin, and from whom she could hear reassuring words to the effect that baby was much better. To such an extent had Natasha let herself go, that the way she dressed and did her hair, her ill-chosen words, and her jealousy — she was jealous of Sonya, of the governess, and of every woman, pretty or plain — were habitual subjects of jest to those around her. The general opinion was that Pierre was under his wife's thumb, which was really true. From the very first days of their married life, Natasha had announced her demands. Pierre was greatly surprised by his wife's view, to him a perfectly novel one, that every moment of his life belonged to her and to the family. His wife's demands astonished him, but they also flattered him, and he submitted to them. Pierre's subjection consisted in the fact that he not only dared to flirt with, but dared not even speak smiling to, any other woman, did not dare to dine at the club as a pastime, did not dare to spend money on a whim, and did not dare absent himself for any length of time except on business, in which his wife included his intellectual pursuits, which she did not in the least understand, but to which she attributed great importance. To make up for this, Pierre had the right of completely regulating his life at home as he chose, as well as that of the whole family. At home, Natasha placed herself in the position of a slave to her husband, and the whole household went on tiptoe when he was occupied. That is, was reading or writing in his study. Pierre had but to show a partiality for anything to get just what he liked done always. He had only to express a wish and Natasha would jump up and run to fulfill it. The entire household was governed according to Pierre's supposed orders, that is, by his wishes, which Natasha tried to guess. Their way of life and place of residence, their acquaintances and ties, Natasha's occupations, the children's upbringing, were all selected not merely with regard to Pierre's expressed wishes, but to what Natasha's supposed wishes to be from the thoughts he expressed in conversation. And she deduced the essentials of his wishes quite correctly, and having once arrived at them, clung to them tenaciously. When Pierre himself wanted to change his mind, she would fight him with his own weapons. Thus, in a time of trouble, ever memorable to him, after the birth of their first child, who was delicate, when they had to change the wet nurse 3 times and Natasha fell ill from despair, Pierre one day told her of Rousseau's view, with which he quite agreed, that to have a wet nurse is unnatural and harmful. When her next baby was born, despite the opposition of her mother, the doctors, and even her husband himself, who were all vigorously opposed to her nursing her baby herself, a thing then unheard of and unconsidered, and considered injurious, she insisted on having her own way and after that nursed all her babies herself. It very often happened that in a moment of irritation, husband and wife would have a dispute, but long afterwards, Pierre, to his surprise and delight, would find in his wife's ideas and actions the very thought against which she had argued, but divested of everything superfluous that, in the excitement of the dispute, he had added when expressing his opinion. After 7 years of marriage, Pierre had the joyous and firm consciousness that he was not a bad man, and mingled and overlapping. But only what was really good in him was reflected in his wife. All that was not quite good was rejected, and this was not the result of logical reasoning, but was a direct and mysterio felt. This because he saw himself reflected in his wife. He felt the good and bad within himself inextricably as a reflection. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. Sorry for the last couple of lines there. I think there's some translation errors because I sort of had to, smooth out those last few sentences so that they actually made some sense. And I don't even think I did a very good job of that, but the way they were written was just all muddled up. Anyway, quickly just going to do our advertising before we dive into the chapter. This podcast is powered by Podbean. I use Podbean to host my podcast, and they distributed it out to all the different podcasting places, iTunes and other ones. I don't know where else, but wherever you're listening to this podcast, it is hosted by Podbean. Podbean's a good place to call the home of your podcast. So if you're thinking of getting into podcasting, you can get a free month of hosting by using my promo thingy. To use my promo thingy, go to podbean.com/ander, and they'll give you a free 1 month of hosting. Thank you very much for your patience there. I think I'm getting worse at doing advertisement reads. I try to keep them short, but I just tend to ramble a little bit when I do them. So this was an interesting chapter. It's good to see we fast forward 7 years in the marriage of Natasha and Pierre and get a little recap of those years and where she's up to now, where Natasha is up to now. And, I don't know, like, funny little relationship. I don't quite get the dynamic. Like, I don't know. I want to see it from Pierre's point of view as well. Because it's like she's calling the shots, but he's quite happy to oblige and they've got a thing going on. And I don't know. It's like not the honeymoon marriage that I was kind of hoping for, but, you know, that was never going to happen, was it? That was just me being wishful thinking. I think I've seen too many Disney movies. But a very interesting dynamic between these two. Ninjastro said, "Guys, she let herself go, okay? Like, I don't know if you were told enough times that she let herself go. Did you hear that she let herself go? Like, what the F, Tolstoy? Is that all you can say about a central character of your book? The things we learned about her own brother last chapter compared to this is just a huge letdown. All I was thinking in my head was, did he just say she got fat and frumpy? Maybe I read that wrong. Nope, he just said it again and again. Oh wow, and again. Fat." he did mention that quite a lot. Although he did say that she's more attractive now than in her former years. So I didn't have fat and frumpy in my head at all. I just had like, I always thought of her as like really like that teenage skinny sort of thing. Like a kind of girlish frame. And then after some babies, I suppose now she has like that womanly frame. So I wasn't thinking fat at all. I wasn't thinking frumpy at all either. But I kind of liked that about Natasha, that she wasn't out there trying to wow society. She'd neglected that common, apparently common advice. At least it must have been common advice in the early 1800s, which was to stay attractive, stay as attractive as possible after you get married and try to keep your husband intrigued. And she pointed out that would just feel weird. It would be almost like trying to like put on nice clothes and do up your hair and sing a seductive song in order to impress yourself. It just felt unnecessary to her. I kind of get that. Like, that doesn't seem too like two-dimensional to me. I didn't get the idea like she let herself go exactly. Like, I wouldn't put it in those words. De Fleury said, "Ha ha 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 ha. Well, at least he didn't go and do the Hollywood thing and pretend that a woman's body doesn't start growing sideways when it stops growing upwards. Not to mention pushing out several Pierre-sized babies." Pierre-sized babies. I just imagine like an actual human-sized baby. Oh, that's a good point. I think Pierre was a big fellow, so he would have large babies. Royal Enigan said, "Lol. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, until he started talking about all the things she'd do before, like sing and dress up. She let herself go, yeah, but also she let herself go." I'm not sure what that means, Royal Enigan. "She let herself go, yeah, but also she let herself go. Natasha gave up these things to give meaning to her life, and to her that meaning was motherhood or something. She let go of herself, the things that she did to draw attention to herself, and this made her happy, I guess. I'm not too keen on the meaning behind this. Maybe this is actually how Tolstoy evaluates relationships, which seems kind of messed up, but it's a different era. Or maybe they're just supposed to be flawed in their own way, like we all are. Or maybe there's supposed to be some deeper meaning, or maybe all of that." Yeah, I think that these days there's like the fact that you say flawed, like it's a flaw for her to be to want to be a mother and for that to give her life meaning. I think that's a really modern thing. And when I say really modern, I think like in the last couple of decades, like I reckon even like 20 years ago, if a little girl was to say, "Oh, I want to be a mummy when I grow up and get married," no one would have been like disappointed to hear that or say, oh, come on, little girl. It's like, oh, okay, that's nice. You want to be a mum. Like it was seen as normal until that recently. I think that's a biological yearning. I think there's a degree of naturalness to wanting to be a mother and be good at it. And when your society would celebrate that as well, and you've got the urge to do it, and society doesn't only support it but also celebrates it, then I can't see like why it would have been a flaw at that time and in that time and place, why that would be a flaw to be that way. I don't think so at all. And it seems like she's quite good at being a mother, and quite good at being a wife. Like Pierre's a bit of a dope, and she seems to have sort of taken the reins and been like, yeah, I'll be the one calling the shots here. So I don't know. Like I guess I just saw it a little differently. Like I'm not saying that I do also understand why people would might be disappointed if a girl was to say something like, I just want to be a good wife and a good mother, because it's like, there's so much more that you could be. And it's like, don't think so little of yourself. Like it's a woman's world as much as a man's world, or at least that's the way we want things to go, right? All things being equal. So like, yeah, I can see why you might be disappointed to hear that. But by the same token, it's like, I would never tell anyone, like if someone says, this is what I want to do with my life, it doesn't matter what they say next, I would never say like, no. Like if someone said, I want to be a fireman, I wouldn't say, oh, I reckon you could be a lawyer. Like, right? It's like, cool. Like, that's a great thing to be. And it's even better, the best thing to be is a person who knows what they want in life. And a person who, once deciding on the thing they want to be, they take pride in that job, I suppose. You could think of it as a not job as in like work job, but in that role. Anyway, different takes. I do also understand why it's like Ninjastro's pointing out, like Tolstoy's just, why is he so stuck on the fact that she's gained weight? Like, it's not relevant. I don't really recall any other parts of the book where he mentioned multiple times that a character has gained weight. Although it is a long book, I don't remember that much. De Fleury said, Natasha, the housefrau, was the biggest surprise of the book. Okay, I mean, like the Titanic movie, we weren't exactly in suspense. Kobiek said, yep, it's a brutal end to a character I had such high hopes for. She just seemed to get sad after her mistakes with Andre, then moped forever, and then coincidentally ran across him just in time to watch him die. Then fat Pierre came along just after, and she said, okay, you'll do, and flash forward, and she's a coward housewife, not great. Biscuit Potter said, that's interesting, she seems happy to me, and my mum. Her aspirations are not exactly a feminist's dream, but she's nursing her own babies, which was very unusual for the time. Why shouldn't she be devoted to her family instead of her looks and appeal? Well, like, it's such a divisive chapter. It's interesting that even Tolstoy mentions in this chapter that Natasha didn't take an interest in the feminists. It would have been the very early inklings of a feminist movement, but he does defer to them in this chapter and mention them in some capacity. And Natasha doesn't even understand that stuff. He says that, like, not only is she not interested, she just doesn't understand it. So it's not her world, and she's happy with her lot in life as being a fairly privileged wife and mother, I suppose. I don't know, like. I just see that as a well-rounded and realistic and quite normal character. I think we tend to put a modern eye on things, and I'm not trying to say like, oh, it was a different time and it was okay then, like that excuse. because it's beyond that. It's like it was normal. I don't know. It is still normal, but we've just got a different lens on things now, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. Like, it's still normal to want to be a good mother and a good wife. And it's still normal to not want to engage in politics, right? Like, that sounds crazy in 2018 because everyone seems to want to engage in politics. But it's all, like, trivial politics that people want to discuss. It's never, like, never goes much beyond the surface, as weird as that is to say. But, I, for example, I'm a person who doesn't really like to engage in political discussions. You probably noticed over 350 something episodes, I haven't really sunk my teeth into anything political because, I don't know, it just, to me, I don't like the conversation. So Natasha being the same way to me, I'm like, yeah, that seems real. I'm not saying it's like how people should be. It might be a bad thing to be. It might be a flaw. But when I think of character design in a book, which I do often, I don't think of like, who should this person be? Like, not everyone in a book is a hero, and not all good people are heroes, right? I still think she's a good person. More importantly, she seems like a real person. And you can't blame an author for creating a real-seeming person, right? Because it's just not fair on authors. And like, it sounds like, you know, I'm trying to stand up for my own here. But in some ways, it's like I let me tell you a personal story. And I just said I don't want to get into politics or that kind of thing, but this isn't politics. It's more like whatever this is. In my first book, there was a character who was I think she was a 14-year-old girl. And she was the daughter of the king, so she was the princess, right? She attempted to assassinate her father, and then got caught and got sentenced to die, right? She got sentenced to be executed. She escaped. This is spoilers for my first novel, but hey, whatever. She escaped, and then she was well and truly in over her head. And at that point, she went into hiding because an army was looking for her, right? So for me, that seems like a pretty realistic teenage person of any gender. But especially for, you know, a young girl, she's not strong. She's not like, she wasn't a superhero or anything. She, you know, physically, she could be overpowered by basically any man in the army because she was a young teenage girl. So she went into hiding. I got a lot of flack from people. I shouldn't say a lot. Like, maybe two people said this to me. But it happened more than once. And people were like, oh, like, I was really disappointed when that character went in hiding. Like, she was kind of a badass, but then she just became a wimp. And it's like, she's like, well, where's, why isn't she a strong female kick-ass female character or whatever everyone was asking, like, strong female lead sort of thing. And I was just like, well, because she wasn't, you know, like, there were heaps of cowards in that book. She wasn't the only coward. And I don't even think she was a coward. I think she was just, like, realistic, like, oh, okay, I'm in over my head now. I'm probably going to die unless I lay low for a bit, right? But it was like, there were people who were disappointed that she didn't, like, put on a cape and suddenly have, like, Superman strength or something. And it's just like, it puts too much pressure on the author to always have every character be a hero, because it's like, oh, if this character represents you, you know, if you're a teenage girl reading the book or a woman or whatever, then you're going to be disappointed by the character that represents you. And it's like, well, then, I don't know, it's just like, it's got, really what that's going to end up with is really boring books, right? Really boring books. Because I don't know. No one said anything about when the main character, who was a boy, did awful things, right? There was no like, oh, well, why did the boy do this awful thing? It was just like, yeah, he was a shitty character. He was a shitty person. He did dickish things. I'm not trying to say all boys are dicks, and I'm not trying to say all girls are cowards. It's just the character doing what they do. But anyway, all boys are dicks. Teenage boys. I can say that. At least I was. Like, the teenage boy who is the main character, he's 13. And he is a little asshole. And I base that on, like, yeah, I remember being a teenage boy, and I remember what other teenage boys are like, and we're just little idiots. Like, I'm embarrassed about how much of a dick I was when I was a teenage boy. And so that's how the character was. And I'm not saying all teenage boys are dicks, but it's not unlikely that it's not like unrealistic to find a dickish teenager boy. Anyway, Natasha seems real to me. And that's what you go for when you create a character. Not every character is a hero. Anyway, that's my rant. I hope I haven't offended anyone. I tend to always sort of rub someone the wrong way when I talk about people. Not, you know, gender specific, just when I mention that teenage boys are dicks or that sometimes people are cowardly or whatever, it's like, I don't know, like, you want to be able to acknowledge the ugly side of people, but doing that can tend to ruffle some feathers. So if I've done that, I do apologize. The real thing you want to do with a character is balance that with what makes them shine, I suppose. What makes them, what's the beauty? What side of them is beautiful? And I saw quite a lot of beauty in Natasha. I think it's quite a beautiful thing to be so devoted to a family. Alright. My spider sense is tingling, like, you should just shut up because people are gonna like argue or I don't really want an argument. I don't mind discussion, so I shouldn't say I don't want an argument because it makes it sound like I'm closed off to responses to what I'm saying, but yeah. I just feel like the more I talk, the more I'm stoking some kind of fire. Speaking of spider senses, tonight I went and watched that new Spider-Man cartoon, Into the Spider-Verse. That was cool. That was really cool. It was like maybe the best looking film I've seen in a long time. Just absolutely visually perfect and entertaining. It was really funny. It was the best Spider-Man film I've ever seen, easily. I don't know why they always kind of seem to screw up Spider-Man films. But this one was really, really good. So there's quite a sharp little change of topic there. Hey, a few people have gone and bought the Hemingway books, the Hemingway List books. So thank you to those people. They're available now. You can search the Hemingway List on Amazon, or you can go to thehemingwaylist.com and you'll find a link to them somewhere on that page. You might have to scroll to the bottom or look on the sidebars. But yeah, you'll find a link to the official paperbacks. The first two are for sale now. Buying those is a good way to support this project, this podcast, and the Hemingway List project. So please, if you're wanting to join us on that journey, get your first couple of books ready now because we'll be starting in early January. Of course, I've got to mention, those books are in the public domain. Right? I'm talking about the Stephen Crane ones and the James Joyce ones. All the books on the Hemingway List, as a matter of fact, are in the public domain, which means you can get them for free. Right? So you do not have to spend money on books in order to be part of this community. We have published our own version, so if you like a nice, slick, brand new paperback edition with the Hemingway List written on the front, then you know where to get them. All right, Thank you very much for listening today. I will see you tomorrow.